From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
I know a place.
All right, so this is the perfect follow-on, I feel like, in many ways, to the conversation we were having about WeWork, because this is next level in a lot of ways. The gathering spot, Ryan Wilson is the founder and CEO. He's here with me in our Atlanta bureau. Ryan, great to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
All right, so I've wanted to talk to you since I started reading Atlanta Magazine and Fast Company, I believe, sort of about what you're up to. This is, and Carol made a joke of this, it's a members-only setup, no jacket required, in a lot of ways. But you're really, I think, an emblem of what's going on in this city right now, this collision of all these different industries. How'd you get this idea?
So the entire thing started when I was in college, right? There was a community that was there that I really didn't appreciate while I was in undergrad. But when I went to law school, I really missed everything about the experience. And if you think about it, when you have people that are from all over the world that are studying different things, that network kind of just goes away immediately. And so with one of my college roommates, we started talking about that problem. And the gathering spot was what resulted out of the conversations.
So tell us a little bit about how it works and who can be, right? Because it's not just open to everybody, right? There's kind of, as I was kidding, members only. So tell us a little bit about who gets to be a part of that community, because it is still kind of selective, right?
It is selective, but I mean, the litmus test for us is really not just what you do, but who you are. The most important question that we ask in our interview process is what animates you outside of the office? And like, we really care about the answer to that question. You'll see a little bit of everybody in the club. The youngest member is 23. The oldest member is 88. And so I tell people all the time, we are in the community business, not the space business. We're looking for opportunities to bring the membership together for professional reasons, and then a lot of times socially as well. And that's been part of the secret of success.
Well, and part of what you do is you bring in interesting folks from, you know, your broader network, a Stacey Abrams,
absolutely.
You know, obviously someone very familiar to our listeners and certainly familiar to folks here in Atlanta. What are you trying to give them with those types of programs?
I think it's important to explore what's going on in the city and going on in our nation. I mean, the club, because we're not tied to any particular industry, we have the ability to really explore any and every topic. And so, absolutely right. Leader Abrams will come and give a conversation, and then the next day we might be doing a midnight brunch. And for us, that's how communities are formed, both for business reasons, but then also for social ones. So, I don't know, the community, depending on when you're there, it looks very different.
Right.
Well, and it's interesting. And you know, Jason and I spend so much time, Ryan, talking about, you know, and you know, talking about the importance of diversity in whatever you do, diversity of thought, and how important it is to really improving the operations and the outcome and the results of any institution, whether it's, you know, one that's out to make money or just one that's out to do good. And it sounds like that's certainly a driving mission within you guys.
I mean, no, the future of communities for us, I mean, they look different. It's important for us as a business to make sure that we're super intentional about making sure that everyone really feels at home inside of the club. One statistic that I'm really proud of is that 60% of our membership base are women. To us, that's what the future of private clubs should look like. These spaces have not been spaces that traditionally have had an overrepresentation of women. And so we go really out of our way to make sure that when there are groups, even professions, we looked last year and found that we didn't have enough educators in the space. And went out and made sure that there were more people that represented that space in the city inside of the club. And so that mix is a part of what, again, makes the club special on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and I'm so glad you brought that up because, and I say this as someone who lived in Atlanta for a long time, very proud of the city in many ways, but when you think about clubs in Atlanta, you think about a bunch of old white dudes. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
And yet, this city is at the cross-section of so many different, as we talked about, industries. How do you ensure that it keeps growing and that, candidly, like, the city overall starts to reflect some of the values that you're trying to put out there?
I mean, Atlanta's a really special place. I mean, there's not many places where you can find such a concentration of Fortune 500 company headquarters and businesses that just have a presence here, generally, sitting right next to a film and music community that's been film is a little bit newer to the city, but music has been here for a long time.
Right.
And then you have a lot of small businesses and entrepreneurs that are driving a lot of the energy down here as well. And so our thesis was bring them together, right? And if there was an opportunity to just kind of make proximity not be a barrier anymore, that magic could really happen. And luckily, that's what's happened.
30 seconds. What could trip Atlanta up at this point? What do you worry the most about?
I think Atlanta has to own what's special about our city and not really try to replicate others. The businesses, we're a city of Spanx and MailChimp and Coca-Cola and Home Depot. And I think sometimes we try to talk about ourselves as being like other cities when what we do down here is special the way it is.
Right. I remember years ago someone, they were saying, you know, Atlanta's got to come up with a new nickname. And, of course, it once was the city too busy to hate. And someone came back and sort of wryly said, the city too busy to come up with a stupid nickname. It needs to focus on what it's good at. Ryan Wilson, what a treat to catch up with you. Founder and CEO of The Gathering Spot here with me in our Atlanta Bureau. All right. Well, we're going to do a special edition of Business Week Economics today. One of our stalwarts, of course, Kathleen Hayes, Global Economics and Policy Editor for Bloomberg. She's back in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. But sitting across from me, Carol Masser, live in the flesh, the man himself.
I'm so jealous.
Steve Matthews.
We're missing you. We're missing you, Carol.
Steve Matthews he's just the backbone of this bureau here. He's been with us for a long time, done a number of jobs, but most recently, and I guess for the past decade or more, Steve, you've been our economics guru in Atlanta. And I want to start, and then I want to get Kathleen's take on this as well. Let's start with the Nobel Prize. Bond markets closed. We don't have to worry about that. But this was a big deal. This Nobel Prize felt like a big deal.
This is a huge deal. Esther Duflo is only the second woman to win the Nobel Prize in economics. She's the youngest ever. And all of that is significant, and, you know, most of the people in the world of economics are familiar with concerns about diversity in economics. There's a real lack of women, a lack of African Americans, and there are lots of barriers to success, which, you know, people like Diane Swonk and in the Wall Street area talk about. So here you have somebody who's a real role model. And also the other really significant thing is this is a new generation. You know, talk about is economics a science? Is it not a science? Esther Duflo is someone who used experiments in economics. So, you know, if in really interesting ways, kind of looking at how do you address poverty, what works, what doesn't, and going to the ground and just kind of doing testing.
And I just love that this is, Steve, you know, where the focus is and the emphasis. I mean, very appreciative of the work that they've done and the research, but I love that people are spending more and more time taking a look at this issue, especially since you think about, you know, we talk so much about the gaps between those who are doing well and those who are not, and that certainly seems to have widened. And I just think it's good for us to spend a lot of time and attention focused on this.
Yeah, there's so much talk about income inequality, wealth inequality, and here's someone who's actually trying to do something about it and in small ways making a difference. I mean, obviously, she doesn't solve the and her partners have not solved the global poverty problem, but in incremental ways, they're making the world a slightly better place.
So, Kathleen, come on in here. What did you read into this selection and to Steve's really good point, sort of the type of work?
Well, I think it's all about the type of work, and it makes me think of the work that's been done in microfinance, how suddenly people who are actually dealing with poor people find out what they really need. For the longest time, I mean, think back to the development economics of the 70s and even going into the 80s, World Bank going in, we're going to build big bridges and things, and that's going to create jobs. And it didn't just always work out that way. So when you're fighting poverty in developing countries, that's one thing. And even in our own country, and I think it's obvious that people are realizing, gee, there's things we need to figure out. And these three together, it's interesting, in fact, that she's married to one of her fellow Nobel Prize winners. So that's really a strong partnership there. They have done work. It isn't just, oh, it's nice, let's do something good for people. It's like, here's significant work right. that can help us figure this out. One more thing I'd like to say about women getting left behind in economics. My look at the Fed covering it over the years, to give the Fed a pat on the back, for a long time, there's been a lot of women who have risen, especially if you go inside the banks. If you're not looking necessarily at the bank presidents and governors, et cetera, women, I think, at the Federal Reserve have long had very important roles.
And so, Steve, we have you here in Atlanta. You are a keen observer of this region, and I am going to ask you about college football. But before I get to that, you have a very important Fed president right down the street, of course. What's the economic view here?
That's really interesting because Rafael Bostic, talking about diversity, is the first African-American Fed president in 100 years and is doing really interesting work. And is talking about interesting issues about inequality, about workforce development. You know, if you look in this region, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, there are areas that are not doing well. The economy, in the view of the Fed, is in a good place, as Jerome Powell puts it. But there are lots of areas that are really not sharing in this amount of success. And that's something that's been a focus of Bostic's in the last year or two.
So you got to talk about football. I'm going to bring it up because I saw Steve Matthews, a picture that you've already tweeted about what you were doing over the weekend.
I was at the Clemson FSU game.
Clemson's your alma mater.
I'm a Clemson alma mater, but everybody in Georgia was obsessed with the Georgia-South Carolina game, with Georgia number three losing, and it was like
unranked South Carolina going to Athens, beating them in double overtime. It was the biggest storyline of the weekend.
Exactly. And in fact, this last week in Atlanta sports, people are saying, you know, it's the worst week in maybe many, many years. Georgia lost, Georgia Tech lost. The Atlanta Braves lost and were in an embarrassing fashion. The Falcons lost twice.
Yeah, it's for a sports town, it is a sad clown sports town. I'd sort of rocked up to a city that is licking its wounds for sure, Carol.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, Kathleen, last word to you. Any questions for Mr. Matthews before we let him go?
Oh, well, first of all, kudos, because Steve, besides doing a lot of things at the Bureau, is just so top-notch on our eco team and his Federal Reserve coverage. So, Steve, quickly to you, have the odds shifted, if there is even – we don't know if there's a hint of a trade deal, but is there – what is the chance that the Fed doesn't cut on October 30th? 30th, that's the word I want.
You know, the market odds are a 70% for a cut. However, Jerome Powell spoke last week in Denver and gave no reason. He said the economy's in a good place, but there are lots of risks. And he said nothing to push people off of the idea that there would be a cut. The minutes came out. They did nothing. So you have to feel like unless somebody pushes back, there's a high likelihood that there will be one more cut.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Steve Matthews, economics reporter for Bloomberg here in our Atlanta Bureau. Really, truly one of the stars of Bloomberg for a long time. And Kathleen Hayes, another star, a shooting star, a bright star, global economics and policy editor for Bloomberg. She's back in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Carol, as we know, when we drill down into the key industries here in Atlanta, security is certainly one of them, and specifically cybersecurity, security writ large. And there's a rich history of that here in Atlanta. And part of that history at the moment, part of that fabric is a company called Averdium. It is run by Jeff Schmidt. He is the CEO. He's here with me in our Atlanta bureau. Jeff, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in. So give us a sense of what you do and sort of in the context of what folks need to know about security writ large right now.
Averdium is a managed security services company. And so what that means for the listeners that are out there, similar to ADT, how they protect your home, we are protecting the networks and systems and applications for the mid to large enterprise. And then we offer professional services or consulting services that deal with things like compliance.
Mm-hmm.
So HIPAA, PCI, CCPA, which is the California Privacy Act that's out there today, and really bringing a pragmatic approach for our customers to simplify security and making it digestible.
Jeff, what's changed over the last couple of years? Because I feel like we've been talking about cybersecurity for some time now, but what's changed in terms of really getting it under control and the managing of it?
Carol, that's a great question. The security landscape has a lot of silver bullets that keep getting promised, so I think that question is really appropriate. With Averdium in our approach is really taking a different view, if you will, on the market and the industry. And so first of all, helping our customers understand their risk and what they need to protect, that's number one. Two is understanding their budgets. Then three is what type of compliance that they need to make certain that they're actually putting in place for the companies that they're, their customers that they have today. So if you're in retail, which is one of the number one industries we work with today, PCI is a big deal, the payment card industry. And what they would be looking for is security controls that protect that credit card information, personal identifiable information, and putting that into a pragmatic approach of making sure that outsiders can't get in, get information. Third parties can't create a hole inside the environment that maybe somebody can get into. And then giving them a way to measure the controls that they put in place to know whether their security is good, needs to be better, or is bad.
So, Jeff, give us a sense of the marketplace right now. You've done a number of startups. You've worked with some big companies as well, including BT. Are we going to see some consolidation? Are we seeing more venture money come in? Where are we in that sense?
The mid to large enterprise is an interesting space, and that's where we're focused on. So think companies that are somewhere around $100 million to $3 billion in revenue that are worried about the proliferation of threats, have a hard time maintaining or having a large staff of security capable individuals. They may have a small team, but not enough to be able to do 7x24 monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Then obviously budgets. And so for us, that's where our focus is. And when you look at that market space, that's where we think that there's a huge gap in the market. And frankly, it's also a place where cybersecurity thieves are focused on because it's an easy place for them to go after because a lot of companies lack that capability.
Well, and I do still wonder, you know, if there's I know there's so much going on, obviously, in the commercial and private sector, but I do wonder about the role of government in terms of cybersecurity, Jeff. I mean, is their role, has it been defined well? Are they doing what they need to do in terms of standards and oversight? Or do you think you don't want them too much involved?
It's a great thing to ask. So when you look at things like CCPA, which is California Privacy Act, and then you take GDPR in Europe, right? So GDPR plays very nicely across Europe. In the U.S., if every state adopts a privacy act or some type of controls around cybersecurity and protecting our data, 50 states with 50 different sets of rules are going to add additional complexity. It's almost, and you think a large company can probably deal with this, the small to medium or the large, kind of that large area of enterprises are going to struggle with it, much like the financial institutions, the large B of A's, JPMC's dealt very easily with Dodd-Frank, but it was the community banks, the credit unions that struggled with it. So again, Averdium playing in this marketplace is trying to help take a framework that works across all of those standards and apply that to the environment. And again, risk in any business is pretty simple, is what are the crown jewels that you don't want stolen? What would happen if that got out inside the public? And could it kill my business if my customers knew that their information got out?
All right. So only about 30 seconds left, Jeff. But this is quite a vibrant scene in Atlanta for your type of business. Why?
Atlanta has a lot to offer. So if you look at ATDC at Georgia Tech, great place incubating cybersecurity. But it has rich roots with companies like ISS,
mm-hmm.
Sold to IBM, Dumbala, which dealt very early with botnets. pin drop security, which is dealing with, it's kind of the opposite side of what we do. It's the phone side and the voice side of security. There's a lot being incubated. There's a rich talent pool also to draw from here in Atlanta.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Great to have you with us, Jeff Schmidt, CEO of Averdium here in our Atlanta Bureau. All right, so continuing my little road trip here to my hometown, Atlanta. This is a special interview in part because I grew up rooting for Georgia Tech and admiring the school. My dad went there, lo, those many years ago. And we've got the new boss with us, President Angel Cabrera. He is the president of Georgia Tech, the Georgia Institute of Technology, here with me in our Atlanta Bureau. So great to meet you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And not a far commute for you. You're just across I-75, 85, excuse me, trying to get my bearings here, and new in the job. Coming back to the place where you did your graduate studies, you had been the president of George Mason, correct?
Absolutely.
And so what have you learned 1 month into your new job?
I thought I knew a lot about Georgia Tech, having graduated from here. I have a son who just graduated in May from in computer science. I've been involved with the Georgia Tech Advisory Board for years, and what I realized is that there is a lot more than I even imagined. Every week I find out a new thing, a new layer, a research project, a student activity that just blows me away. It's been unbelievable. This last 6 weeks have been just phenomenal.
So a lot of moving parts, and I do think when you're president of a prestigious institute, university like yourself, how do you prioritize what needs to take up kind of, you know, what really gets your time, especially when you come into a position?
It is indeed a very intense job with multiple pressures that pull you in many, many different directions. But that's why this year, and that one of the most exciting things that I'm working on is to produce a new vision and a new strategic plan for the school. So I'm having a lot of fun. I'm having meetings with deans, with faculty members, with students, with elected officials, with business leaders to say, okay, what do we all want Georgia Tech to become over the next decade? So in a way, I have given myself the most part of this year to answer that question. And it's fantastic because I'm getting to learn a lot more about the institute that I knew, and I'm getting people quite excited.
So, Dr. Cabrera, you know, President Cabrera, when you first came into the studio here, you and I were talking about sort of literally where we're sitting. You know, our bureau is relatively, over the past few years, recently relocated to this Midtown area, and this is your neighborhood in a lot of ways. And one of the things that Georgia Tech has done is really expanded eastward into this part of Midtown and really helped revitalize it. Talk about what you're hearing from business leaders here about what they need from Georgia Tech.
So we are so close that I actually rode my bike from my office to come see you. And this is something that when I was a grad student here, I would have not done.
Not a chance.
And the impact that Georgia Tech has had in Midtown and in Atlanta at large has been phenomenal. When I was in Virginia, I would send some of my colleagues here to see what was happening in Atlanta. And it's a combination of not just urban development and really triggering a revolution in what's going on in this area. But it's a revolution grounded on innovation and entrepreneurship, a beautiful piece of what happened in Midtown in the area we call Tech Square, was driven by some of the biggest employers in Atlanta who decided to open their innovation labs right there to tap the innovation that was happening at the Institute.
And how do you convince students to stay in Atlanta? I mean, what do you have to do? I know you have a co-op program that sort of gets them into those companies earlier, but you must worry a little bit about a little bit of brain drain after they graduate and go off to Silicon Valley or somewhere else, right?
I have a perspective on that, which is not necessarily shared by a lot of people, which In my view, even when many of our graduates leave and go work in London or in the Silicon Valley or in Boston, that is a net gain for Atlanta. That is social capital that we're developing, personal connections that can translate into business connections in unforeseen ways. But the reality is that more and more of our graduates choose to stay in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Atlanta has become an incredibly fun place to be, and a place where many of our graduates, even the entrepreneurially inclined, would prefer to have their new ventures here. The cost of living, the cost of hiring talent in Atlanta is far superior, actually lower than what you would find in places like Silicon Valley mm-hmm. or New York City. So it's actually becoming a much better choice for many of our students.
So I'm going to just jump in because we only have about a minute left. But this whole college admission scandal, I'm just curious your perspective on it.
It is sad that people go through that level of even misconduct. There's this obsession with getting their kids into a number of schools. You know, this country is blessed with hundreds and hundreds of wonderful institutions with very different profiles. There is a school virtually for everyone, and people who go to all sorts of institutions can end up doing very, very well. So I think it's a little bit of a reflection of an unhealthy aspect of the culture that we have created, and hopefully this will come down to a much better place in the future.
All right, 30 seconds left. I'm going to ask you one more question, which is just about affordability. Are we going to see some work done to make college broadly more affordable? Your school is a pretty good deal, but some work needs to be done here.
We're doing our share, and as you know, in Georgia, students have access to HOPE and Zelle scholarships that lower the price considerably. We even have our Promise scholarship at Georgia Tech for students with very low income. So it's a top priority for us, and it will continue to be.
All right. We really appreciate the time. I can't wait to get a report card from you as you get deeper into this new job. President Angel Cabrera, he is the president of Georgia Tech, working on a lot of different projects here in the first 6 weeks in his new job, coming home in a way to Atlanta where he did his graduate studies.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
But times are strange and people change, so just try to remember to hedge your bets.
All right, so let's get into the world of investing here as we start to wind down our show, Carol. Dr. Kirsten Travers-Wehem is with me. She is managing partner for Rivercam Advisors, also an adjunct finance professor over at Goizueta School of Business, of course, Emory University. Shout out to them. Jen Kelly went there, as you know, Carol Masser. So, Dr. Travers-Wehem, thank you so much for being with us. You've started a hedge fund. You have an amazing history. And Carol, I will say, I know you read in on this. She is knock you back smart. So I have so many questions. Why start a fund?
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been an extremely exciting time to start a hedge fund about 2 years ago. And, you know, 2019 certainly has been a year of extreme event risk. You know, we've been dealing, as you're all covering, with the trade wars, with Brexit, with just very high geopolitical risk around the world. And the fun thing for me for running a fund is to take a much longer term risk. So while the headlines, of course, drive asset prices, I think the real key to investing is to really try and understand the way the world works. I take a top-down global macro view of the world, look for themes, look for new innovations that are creating value, look for cyclical rotations around different regions of the world. And it really provides a lot of opportunities, irrespective of what the day-to-day stock market and treasury markets are doing.
So, Kirsten, take something like U.S.-China trade, right? And I think investors trying to make some sense out of what happened on Friday. Friday, this mini trade deal. Our conversations today are saying, you know, nothing was put down on paper, nothing was signed officially, and, you know, we just don't know quite where it's going. So how would you play that big macro story?
Well, I certainly think the trade war, you know, day to day, it's whipsawing the markets. You know, on Friday, there was an announcement of a deal. I think both sides are greatly incented to try and come up with a deal, certainly before the 2020 election over here. And, you know, China has issues of its own that they're wanting to have a win with this trade war. I think what it's certainly done is eroded confidence globally. And rather than try to play the day-to-day changes and try and play the headlines, which, you know, is just impossible over the long term, the way that I'm looking at that is, you know, generally it's cut into confidence. So, you know, we've got lots of economic news coming up in the next few months with earnings season and monetary policy reports from the U.S. and around the world. But really, at this point in the cycle, the U.S. has really very little room left for any kind of easing and stimulus. You know, we've already done monetary easing. We've had tax cuts. So the way that I would play that is to think that rather than the U.S. dollar being a long-term safe haven currency with strength of currency, I think we're going to see a cycle in that now. We're going to see the euro and the pound, which are, you know, undervalued by traditional means, but also, you know, they've been dealing with a lot themselves with uncertainty. I think they're going to start to strengthen. I think that they have much more room for fiscal stimuli with government spending and tax cuts. You know, Germany has no new debt. So I think moving forwards, you know, the growth opportunities in the U.S. are going to start to have to give up their strength to other regions of the world. And we can play that across various markets, not just the currency markets with those two currencies I mentioned, but, you know, across the commodities markets. Rather than just have a trade deal play, I try to take into account the dollar starting to look as if it's going to weaken with a lot of other fundamentals. So, for example, in commodity space, the sugar market, you know, has been building quite a solid base this year. I think it's up about 4% year to date. But after many years of oversupply, we're now looking at forecasts of production deficits. There's still, same with the euro, a huge hedge fund right. short position that needs to be unwound that should help positive momentum yeah. with sugar markets. Same with coffee, although I think we're earlier in the cycle with coffee. But taking bigger picture ideas and then also trying to blend them with really long-term changes in global issues like climate change, energy independence, waste and recycling, all of these long-term themes, we try to piece together positions that will be, you know, continuously profitable, irrespective right. of where we're going with things like trade wars.
So only got about 30 seconds left, but I got to ask you, you are a rare bird in the sense of being a female hedge fund manager. Again, we only have about 30 seconds left. What do we do to change this?
Well, thank you for commenting on that. I think that, you know, I went to an all-girls school. I'm a mathematician. I really didn't realize that girls and women didn't do these things when I was growing up. And it's, you know, it's harder to aspire to things where you can't see people already doing that thing. So I think there's so much investment going on in financial institutions and large corporate America to getting women in the door. I think that we need to then follow through and really get to women in leadership so that girls and women can aspire to being in those positions.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Dr. Kirsten Travers-Wehem is managing partner of River Cam Advisors, also an adjunct finance professor, at Goizueta School of Business at Emory University. You know, Carol, sometimes I really do get the best assignments, and
yes.
I do wish you were here because it's a special on-the-road edition of Sip or Sweat. It's a Monday, and I'm voting Sip because Jim Chasteen is here with me. He's the CEO, and this is the best title ever, licensed bootlegger for ASW Distillery. He's here with me in our Atlanta bureau. Jim, great to meet you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Carol. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. And I have to say, Carol, shout out to Dennis Kelly, my dad, who is a local here. And he was the one who actually introduced me virtually to Jim because he tasted some of his whiskey and he's a fan. And as you know, Carol, Dennis Kelly has a discerning palate.
Does.
So, Jim, tell us what you're up to because this is super cool.
Man, we have had just an awesome time. I'm a former finance guy. Used to be securities licensed. And my partner, Charlie Thompson, and I were roommates at Georgia. I just thought it was so appropriate that, you know, you just had Dr. Cabrera from Georgia Tech here and then, you know, Georgia represented by a distiller on
yeah,
air.
Which it makes is, sense. It checks out.
Ideal. So he and I met at Georgia, and we allegedly had a little hobby making whiskey, and we kind of figured out a way to turn it into a career and just ended up at the apex of just a lot of trends that very candidly are much larger than us that we didn't see coming but have benefited from, you know, the rise in the craft movement. You've had craft beer, and now craft spirits are coming along on the tail of that. The foodie culture, agriculture, everybody cares where their food's coming from. And so the experiential nature of, you know, meeting your dad and coming into a distillery and showing him how we make things and showing him two beautiful pot stills here in the middle of downtown Atlanta. You would not have seen, if you were asking a distiller 100 years ago if that was possible, no way.
No way, not a chance.
So the progress that's been made on these trends, and just we've benefited from a ton of that stuff.
Why no way?
Well, that's a long answer. I mean, you've just got a lot of history in the South. You know, it's kind of what we're known for is the people are very nostalgic about the 40 Fords running from, you know, the revenuers here. I mean, that was a dirt road called Piedmont back in the day. I mean, this was all happening yards from our current distillery where you had the trippers coming down from the mountains sending booze here, and now we're sending booze the opposite way, which is amazing.
And so tell us about that sort of mega trend that you referenced, which is we are at this moment, and Carol, you and I talk about it so much, whether it comes to food or fashion.
Right.
Like, we want to know where stuff comes from at this point, and we really value understanding the story.
90% of our guests do our tour because they care about what we do. There's something. It's just a big old chemistry set down the road. You know, we have a ton of Georgia Tech folks in town that, you know, took chemical engineering. We have a ton of ag guys from Georgia that want to come in and see how we, you know, become alchemists and spin, you know, straw into gold. So, yeah, I just think it's what people, you know, and the South is cool right now. People are watching what we're doing here and saying, man, the trends here, food, beverage,
right.
Restaurant in the South is just, you know, really on a global stage right now. And we've benefited from that tremendously.
Jim, how do you get noticed, though? Because I feel like there are a lot, like you said, kind of the craft trend that we're seeing when it comes to all kinds of alcohol. And how do you get yourself noticed in what is increasingly becoming a crowded space?
Same thing we do in any, you know, you got to distinguish yourself with quality. It's a little bit overwhelming right now, but people lump us in with beer, but we're literally 25 years behind craft beer. So there are a lot fewer distilleries out there. And nationally, we enter these spirit competitions. The biggest by far in North America is the San Francisco World Spirit Competition. Last year, we came home with 5 medals, including a double gold for our Duality double malt whiskey, which, as you know, robust as the Georgia spirit-making tradition is, that was actually the first time a Georgia whiskey had ever received that honor in San Francisco, which was huge for us. And then this year we came home with another 5 medals, including a gold medal for our single malt Burns Night, which is a traditional barley single malt, similar to a Highland-style whiskey. And, you know, for a tiny little distillery, you know, under 5-year-old distillery in Atlanta, Georgia, to win a gold medal for a single malt in the single malt category got us a little bit of attention, and that was huge.
So talk about distribution, because obviously if you want people to be fans of it, they got to drink it, they got to be able to find it. How do you pull that off?
Well, the brewers and distillers a couple years ago in Georgia got the laws changed so we can now sell direct. We were the last state in the union that couldn't sell directly out of a tasting room. And that is by far our biggest mouthpiece. Your dad's already brought friends in, you know, to show them that. And we look at it as a way to make money, but it's really more of a marketing strategy for us to bring people in. We love on them. We teach them something. We never talk down to anybody. And that That, I think, from the laid-back tradition of spirits has really been a way that we've distinguished ourselves as, you know, we understand there are a lot of new spirit drinkers that need to learn something, and you would never walk into our tasting room and have somebody, you know, poo-poo on something you said or a question you asked or something like that. We're going to try to emulate what the craft beer guys did an awesome job of, which is to bring new consumers into the market by educating them and becoming fans.
So, Jim, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, almost 5 o'clock certainly here in New York. Not quite there, I think, in Atlanta, right? Is there
an
hour?
No, we're the same time.
Oh, you are.
Oh, Carol Masser, goodness gracious. You know, you
we're not in a time
world
warp here.
Apart.
You take the girl out of New Jersey, but good Lord, where do you think we are?
I don't know. It's Monday. I'm a little tired. So tell me what, I'm assuming you guys are going to sample something.
We're actually not going to sample.
Jim.
He's going to come down.
Because actually, and this actually leads to a place I wanted to go with Jim, which is you just came from a hike. You know, I mean, part of what you're selling, I think, in some ways, and what's going on in Atlanta is it's a different lifestyle in many ways. And I've heard it, you know, and I think we've heard this all day long. There's something kind of special going on here where people are living kind of a different life.
I agree with that 100%. This is purely just, you know, me speculating, but I believe as a city we lost a lot of identity after the Olympics. I mean, there was so much of an influx of people from all over, and we have benefited a ton from people moving here, but it kind of diluted the culture, and now what you're seeing is it fight its way back through the food community, through this beautiful nature that we have. I mean, you are in ag land, you know, 20 or 30 minutes outside of town in Atlanta, Georgia. And I do think that ties really well into our story.
Right. Well, and Carol, you know, I just think about, you know, the conversations that we had earlier, you know, with Ryan and the gathering spot, you know, this collision of all these different industries that are happening, whether it's more traditional business, real estate, which is business Jim was in before he did this distillery, whether it is telecommunications, whether it's entertainment, whether it's music, so much happening here. Jim Chasteen is CEO and licensed bootlegger down at ASW Distillery down the road from where I am. Carol, I think I'm going to stay another day if that's all right with you.
I think
come
that's
see us.
Okay. Absolutely. Next time I'm coming. And I want one of those titles. I love that title.
And you need to see it this weekend. We will be releasing the first straight bourbon distilled in Atlanta, Georgia since before Prohibition.
I've got my name attached to one of those.
Getting on a plane.
I know Dennis Kelly's going to pick one of those up for me.
And there's no time difference, so what the heck?
Yeah, there's no time difference.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Carol. Well, I head down to Atlanta, and lucky for me, get to link up with a guy that is one of our constant go-tos, especially when it comes to the world of technology. He's here with us for today's Drive to the Close. That's Dan Morgan, Vice President, Senior Portfolio Manager at Synovus Trust Company. They're looking after about $24.2 billion just up the road from us here in Atlanta, but he's here with me in our Atlanta bureau. Dan, what a treat. Great to see you.
This is great.
It's been a long time since we've seen each other face-to-face, but not so long since we last talked. And it's the perfect time to talk to you because we're about to hear from some of the big tech names. Let's talk a little Netflix.
Yeah, so Jason and Carol, we've got Wednesday coming out with the two leading companies, Netflix and IBM. And you know, the consensus on Netflix is, 7 million subscribers. They came a little bit short on the second quarter, 6.2 million international, 800,000 domestically. But, you know, Jason and Carol, when you think about what's in the back of everybody's minds is we know that Apple has got their release of their new service, their $4.99 streaming service. It's going to come out in November. And Disney with the Hulu and the $6.99 service also coming out in November. So we look at this quarter, this third quarter that's closing down, and it's kind of like, okay, well, that's interesting, but you've got a lot of things coming down the pipe here in the next couple of weeks, so watch out.
Yeah, exactly. I just feel like this whole space is getting really, really crowded. And I know just in our own household, it's like, all right, we're just going to kind of limit this and whittle it down to what we really think we're interested in. I don't have enough time to look at all this stuff. So I do wonder how you look at kind of the longer term outlook for the world of streaming.
Well, I think the key thing, Carol, is obviously how much money each of these streaming services is spending on new content, right? We've talked about this before. We've covered Netflix together. And I think we kind of came to the agreement that, yeah, it's great to have old reruns of Friends and Seinfeld and all these different old shows everybody likes to watch. But really what hooks people to stay on every month is this new content. And, you know, you think about Netflix, obviously, you know, 7.5 to 8 billion. That's their content spend rate. Really, the only one that's really close is Amazon. They're about 6 to 7 billion. And then you look at like a Disney with that monster library, right? The Star Wars, the Pixel, the Marvel, and all the things they're doing in movies and so forth. So it's, I think when you got to look at streaming, you got to look at, well, how much are you going to put into content? How are you going to keep people engaged and continue to stay with you month to month? You just can't rerun, you know, the old shows.
How soon before we start to get somebody who bundles all of these streaming services and we're kind of back to the cable model?
Well, that would be interesting, right? It's a counter to what we just went through, right? It was break up the cable stations, right? And everyone streams what they like, ESPN, Disney, or whatever. And now you go the other direction where you get Apple, Disney, Amazon, right, as a bundle against Netflix.
Right.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see if somebody can package that together. We haven't seen that quite yet, though, Carol.
Well, speaking of getting together, putting things together, IBM, obviously that massive acquisition of Red Hat, Dan, how soon are we going to really get a sense of what this new look IBM looks like, especially as we prepare to hear from them, as you say, this week as well?
Well, you're right, Jason. So we got IBM coming out Wednesday with Netflix. IBM, as you said, I mean, it's kind of a wait and see stock, right?
Yeah.
Because you've got this huge acquisition that they've done. Everybody listened to the road show, so to speak, or afterwards talking about this hybrid cloud, which is kind of a combo of two things, so to speak. And is this going to pay off for IBM? And, you know, you look at the real growth that everyone was focusing on before, their strategic imperatives. That's the artificial intelligence, security, social, all these different things that sound really sexy. And that's about 50% of their total revenues. If you go back and look at fiscal year 2018, it grew at about 9%. But now the new story is Red Hat, right? And how can they digest that thing and really make it work? And it could be exciting for them, Carol and Jason. I mean, if you think about the huge installation base of customers that IBM has and be able to sell those Red Hat products through that channel, it could work. But it's going to be a task for them, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Is it going to finally, though, change the fortunes, right? We've talked so often about when it comes to IBM, you know, all these bets that they're making, but we talk about what's going on in revenues and, you know, cost cutting has certainly been a big part of their story in terms of meeting some of their numbers. So is this it that kind of could be the turnaround for
this
IBM,
is it,
ultimately?
Carol.
Yeah, this is it. And if they so what if it doesn't work out, Dan, then what?
It's going to be really tough. I mean, this is one of the largest deals they've ever done. I mean, you guys have been around like a while, like myself. You probably remember WebSphere. You probably remember some of these companies that they gobbled up along the way, and we kind of forget about the names of these companies, a lot of software companies. But this is by far the biggest deal that they've done. So you're right, Carol. You look at even this quarter coming out, which is going to be their Q3 19, we're looking for revenues to be down again, 2.7%, roughly about $18.25 billion. So how do you get the growth catalyst back in this company? You know, we think back, you know, back in the late 80s when they went through that big downturn in the mainframe space with all the international competition, they somehow pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, became a huge service company, and then had that nice run. So you're right, Carol. Is this going to be that next big boost for IBM that we've been waiting for that seems to come along about every 20 years?
Well, and obviously it's going to be Ginni Rometty's legacy. It feels like it is really on the line here at IBM. So broadly speaking, Dan Morgan, tech, what's the feel as we go into earnings across the universe that you look at?
Well, it's interesting, Jason. I was just checking this as I was coming in to do the show, and you look at technology as a whole, as gauged by, let's say, the S&P 500 information technology benchmark, up 31.59%. S&P's up 18, the Dow Jones is up 15%. So tech has still been the place to be, right? It's still doing really well despite tariffs and everything else. And if you go into this third quarter, I mean, you're still looking at kind of flat to slightly down consensus in terms of earnings. But there's still so many areas of excitement, you know, like the cloud is an area that should do and has done extremely well in the past. We're starting to get a little bit of revival in the chip space, you know, maybe a little ahead of ourselves, but that area too could be something dynamic. Carol, I'm sorry.
No, but I was just going to, forgive me because I'm breaking in, but I just want, you know, 30 seconds on you, what we're seeing in terms of the results and what we're hearing from companies, or at least what you're expecting, nothing to you points to recession here in the United States or even globally?
I think the only connection I can make is in terms of the tariffs and the direct impact on CIOs and CEOs' attitudes towards CapEx. Yeah. And is that going to eventually lead to a slowdown in spending, which then could hurt tech spending? So far, we haven't seen it. But at this point in time, I think we just have to keep chugging along through this third quarter with our heads high. But I'll try to signal to you and Jason when I see that green leaf coming up underneath the stone that I'm starting to see things slow down.
We're going
to
hold you to it.
Thank you.
Absolutely are. Dan Morgan, you are the man. Always great to catch up with you. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.